Peter Mawson. Sunday morning. 19th of March, 2017. John chapter 9, verse 1, to John chapter 9, verse 34.
Well, good morning, everyone. As John has said, my name is Peter. I'm the minister here. We welcome you all, whether you're regular attenders or whether you're visitors. We want you to feel comfortable, and we also want us all really to understand what God has to say to us this morning through his word, the Bible. Do turn with me to the passage that we looked at just a few moments ago. It's a long passage. We read the whole of the chapter, not something we always do, but it all hangs together this morning. And chapter 9 of John's Gospel is page 1075, if you have a church Bible, which there should be one pretty well close to you. Well, it doesn't take a genius, whether you're a preacher or not, to see what the theme of this morning is. The whole story revolves around a blind man, someone who was blind from birth, who is by Jesus given his sight. So we are very clear, aren't we, on where the theme is today. And that is we're talking about moving from blindness to sight, from darkness to light, and as Jesus says in verse 4, from day and night, night into day, Jesus speaks of those things. What's interesting is how this occurs in John's Gospel in the way that it does, because this business of darkness and light, this contrasting theme, is something that John has spoken about right at the very beginning of his gospel, and many of you will remember it, I'm sure. And he made the point there about the Lord Jesus and the coming of Jesus into this earth, that in him was life, that is Jesus, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. He says again, just a few verses later, so that those of us at Trinity don't miss it. I'm grateful to John, really, that he was thinking of us when he wrote this, and he wants us to get it absolutely clear in our minds what this is all about. Verse 9, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. Verse 14, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And here it is. We have seen, there's the light, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So there we are. We know where we are this morning. We know where we're going. We're going to be talking of darkness and of light. And I want to talk to begin with about the light shining. As we open this passage, it's very important to remember what happened before. If you're a visitor, I need to just praise you where we were last week, because it was an important place. If you just glance up into chapter 8, just above the chapter we're reading, you will see there a crisis moment when Jesus speaks about himself and uses this phrase, I am. And this causes eruptions. It basically means that the people around him turn into a murderous mob, because Jesus has used that phrase, I am, three times in that chapter. And the phrase, if we remember, is Jesus taking on to himself the Old Testament name of God. That was the name the Jews would have known him as. It is I am. That is how God revealed himself in the Old Testament. That is his personal name, if you like. And Jesus, without any embarrassment, takes the name of God and applies it to himself. I am. And so the Jews are unmistakably upset because he has taken on to himself the name of God. In other words, as we ended last week, we said that standing in the dusty streets of Jerusalem is God. That is unmistakable. What Jesus is saying. However, there are seven places in John's Gospel where he uses that term, but he uses it in a complete sentence. So we have a subject, and as we know, all of you are English specialists, a predicate. So we have Jesus saying, I am so-and-so. So in chapter 6, for instance, we had Jesus speaking to the Jews and saying, in verse 35 of chapter 6, Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Quite a statement. So Jesus has said, I am the bread of life. And then here we are in chapter 9, where Jesus uses the same formula, and he says, while I am in the world, verse 5, I am the light of the world. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. In fact, that refers back to something he's already said. This is a repeat, because in verse 12 of chapter 8, Jesus said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, we have tried to impress on ourselves how important these words are of Jesus. The trouble for us all sitting here is that, quite frankly, you're all too polite. That's your big problem. You are an exceptionally polite, refined, and highly polished people. But the reality is, we should feel upset. We should feel almost insulted, to be honest, that what Jesus has just said. I am the light of the world. Now, we should be upset because of what he is claiming for himself, that he is the light, not a light. He doesn't put himself along other philosophers and other religious people and other religions and other good people. He says, I am, exceptionally so, the light. I am uniquely the light. But he is saying something about the world, isn't he? He is saying, I am the light of the world. And if you know this light, you won't walk in darkness. So he's speaking, in a way, by implication, something derogatory about the world that we live in. Now, that should insult us in a way, because, let's face it, many of us love this world. I saw a program just last night on the television about the west of Ireland. And it's a very beautiful place. I've never been there, but it is very beautiful. And so there is a great deal about our world which is very beautiful. And after all, for most of us, that's all we've got. The world is all there is for us. This is where we live. This is where we work. This is the world that we are passing through. And it's everything to us. But of course, Jesus is saying there can be seen also a darkness in this world. In fact, as someone has once said, the world is, nature itself is red in tooth and claw. And the appeal this morning about East Africa and Yemen just points out the state of huge swathes of our world, in hunger and in war and bloodshed and corruption and all the rest of it. And so there is a darkness out there which we can actually look at and feel terribly sad about this morning. I mean, it's heartbreaking stuff, isn't it? There isn't one of us here who does not feel moved at 16 to 19 million people starving to death today. But the problem with that is it's sort of out there somewhere. But you see, as we've discovered in John's Gospel, when John speaks of the world, he makes it personal. Because he's not thinking geographically, the world we are standing upon, this globe in space. He is speaking about moral things. He is speaking morally and spiritually. And he is saying, in this world, without Jesus, this is where the insult comes, without Jesus, in this world, we are living individually in darkness. And of course, we don't like that. And the people who listened to Jesus in his day didn't like it, that's for sure. They were religious Jews. But Jesus says, without me, you are living in darkness. Now, I want to just explain this a little bit, because there are symptoms of this. Now, we all know what symptoms are. We've all had illnesses or are ill and so on. We know that symptoms show themselves. They're not necessarily the illness itself, but they show what's going on in our bodies. And there are symptoms for this. And one of the things I would challenge you with is the very simple fact that for just about every one of us, there is this desire for the best, which always seems to be that which is to come. Whatever pleasure we are enjoying, whatever is happening to us, and it can be wonderful and euphoric and all the rest of it, there's always this sense that the best is somewhere out there. We haven't quite reached it. And so we buy our new cars because we think that's going to make our lives complete, or we buy our new house because we think that will really help us, or we invest all our time and energy into our families, or for many of us, we have invested all our time and energy into our work, and we think as long as we invest in all of that and we have our pension funds and we have our holidays, then life is going to be great. Life is going to be good. But the truth is that it is a lie. And there isn't one of us that in the silence of our own rooms and in the silence of our own heads, I don't mean that you're empty-headed, you understand that, but in the silence of our own heads, we know that that is so. Though the best is somewhere out there and it's across the horizon and we can't quite reach it and we want it, but it's not there. And many people end up in the end of their lives looking back on a life of emptiness and wondering what was that all about. And then in the midst of all of this sense that there must be more to life than this is the terrible loneliness that seems to pervade our 21st century. There's so many people, we appear to, in statistically it is said, who are just lonely, who are depressed in their loneliness, who even in the midst of family and friends seem feel a pervading sense of loneliness. Some cynical wit said that I envy the paranoid because they seem to think somebody's taking notice of them. And the reality is, often we feel nobody's taking any notice of us. And there are many people, and it isn't just the elderly. There are many young people who have a pervading sense of loneliness in their lives, an emptiness, a sense that nobody loves them, nobody cares about them, that they're meaningless. And then we have the simple fact that we realize we are not what we want to be. We may be looking for the best, but we know inwardly we're not the best. We've messed things up. Some people end their lives looking back on a life of just a trail of destruction. Just every mistake that you can make has been made. And it can never be returned to. It can never be put right. We know that there are things in our lives which we are upset about, that in the loneliness and in the quiet, we would rather not have our consciences working, that in the middle of the night, we hear that voice that reminds us of those terrible things that we have done or said or thought that may have done damage to us and may have done damage to others. Do you remember how this story begins? It begins by the disciples incorrectly, wrongly, attributing this man who was born blind to sin. Either sin in his life, which is rather hard to imagine when he was born blind, or sin in his parents' life. And Jesus puts them right and says, no, this illness, this blindness has nothing to do with that. But we know that in our own lives, that often we do have a destructive tendency, and there is nothing we can do about it. How many of us would love to turn the clock back and put right what we've done wrong and start again? Isn't it true? See, Jesus speaks of the fact that our world, our personal world, can be very dark. There's a couple of quotes I came across this week that I want to read to you. One of them is a difficult one, but it needs reading because it's by Bertrand Russell, who is one of the greatest minds of the 20th century, a humanist and an atheist, but a terrific mind. Now, I have to tell you, I don't read Bertrand Russell philosophy just as I'm eating my cornflakes, but I do come across him from time to time, and I admire him. Why? Because as an atheist and a materialist, and a humanist, he didn't believe in any future, in any God. Listen to what he says about the world. I admire him for his honesty. I'm sorry about the language, which is a bit sort of involved. Man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. There was no purpose about the fact that we're on this earth. That's what he says. that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. Collocation is not a word I use very often, but it means the gathering together of things, as you can understand. It just happened that these atoms, the slime, sort of fused somehow, and out of it came something that eventually becomes human. Evolution. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, actually they are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. I beg to differ. But this is the point. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on this firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Do you get it? He actually looks at the world, and it looks back at him, and he only sees despair. That is what he saw. There is no meaning. There is no hope. There is no purpose. There is no future. There is no eternity. That is Bertrand Russell and millions of other people's philosophy. It is only despair. And a philosopher in the 17th century, which I also do not read just at breakfast time, says this, and he says it more clearly, Blaise Pascal, we desire truth and find in ourselves nothing but uncertainty. That's what I've just been saying. We seek happiness and find only wretchedness and death. We're incapable of not desiring truth and happiness, and yet incapable of either certainty or happiness. There is a diagnosis of the human condition. Do you not see that? If you don't feel like that, I can promise you many do. That is a diagnosis of our world. That is the diagnosis that Jesus gives, in a sense. He says, without my light, you are in darkness, and it's the darkness of despair and hopelessness and helplessness and meaningless and purposelessness. But Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And so there is the hope, that in Jesus is a light that shines into the recesses of our hearts and changes everything. He brings forgiveness. This Jesus brings hope. This Jesus brings purpose. This Jesus dispels loneliness. This Jesus brings eternity. He is the light of the world. Is he your light? That's why John is writing this. Is he your light? I want to next just talk about light to darkness. I mean, this is an amazing story, isn't it? The trouble is we read our Bibles so passionless that we just don't get it, what is actually being written. It is an amazing story of a man who was congenitally blind and in a moment of time sees like the rest of us. That is pretty big stuff, isn't it? It's pretty amazing. You could say unbelievable, but John is recording the facts as he knew them. He was there. He was a disciple of Jesus. He saw it. So it's an amazing story. But there is a sadness in this story. That's the thing I want to get to. There is something in this story which is very unnerving and disturbing, and it's not what you would expect. You would expect wonderful rejoicing over a man who had been begging and just holding his life together because of his disability, is now able to see like the rest of us. And his life has changed in a moment. You'd think that would be glorious, but it's not for the people around. We have this questioning by his neighbors. Verse 8, His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?" And some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him. We can't believe it happened." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they asked. A good question. And he tells them. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes, and he told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see." Precise reply. "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. But he doesn't stop there. So they are puzzled by this, and you and I would be too. And we would want to ask questions, wouldn't we? We wouldn't just accept it on face value. And they don't. So they take the man to the Pharisees, verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. And that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. They weren't being vindictive. They weren't trying to trip this man up or something. Taking him to the Pharisees, who were the religious people, the religious leaders, the sort of priests of the day, was a perfectly reasonable thing. I mean, they should know what's going on. They knew their theology, they knew their Bibles, they knew God, supposedly, so they could analyze what has happened here. And so they were the men to take him to. Let's see where the inquiry takes us. And as we read this, we see that they are, in many degrees, very puzzled. Some of the Pharisees, we read, verse 16, said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner perform such signs?" So they were divided. So within this group of Pharisees, there was a division. There were those who really were thinking something remarkable here has happened, and it must be a godly thing, and there were others who were doubting that. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? That as you read the Gospels, this is what happens all the time. There is always a division. Wherever the light of Jesus is, there is always a division of people. I will have no doubts in my own mind that even sitting here, us here this morning, and I've already flattered you by saying how polite you are, the reality is there will be a division. There will be a division of those who are attracted to the light of Jesus, and there are those who are repulsed by it. There will be those who will want to know about this Jesus, and there will be those who will want to close their mind to him. And that is what is happening here. In fact, where the depression comes for me, where the sadness comes, is the fact of the way that they analyze what has happened. Now, the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. "He put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed, and now I see." And some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." Now, we have landed back where we have landed so many times with these Pharisees. What they see is that by healing this man on the Sabbath, the Jewish holy day, he had violated the Ten Commandments. The healing was work, and you weren't to work on the Sabbath. So Jesus has already dismissed. He has broken the Sabbath. Actually, he's broken it in three ways. It's interesting how John repeats what the man has said, that he made mud on my eyes and I washed and now I can see. That is said more than once. Why? Well, you see, in the Pharisaical law, people couldn't even knead bread. Is that the word? Yeah, okay, it'll do. You know what I mean. You can show how much of that I do. So when you make bread, you knead it, yes? With your hands, with me so far. You couldn't do that, because that's work. So he'd healed on the Sabbath, he'd worked. He'd also made mud with his hands, broken the Sabbath. He had also anointed the man's eyes with the mud. He'd broken the law. It was as detailed and as pernickety as that. Jesus had broken the Sabbath. And so they say, they said, "This man is not from God," verse 16, "for he does not keep the Sabbath." That is their criteria for a godly man. That is where they are. From that moment on, as I read this chapter, if it wasn't so sad, it would almost be farce, wouldn't it? Because they then start to question the man. And having done that, they then call his parents. He's a grown man, but they call his parents. They still do not believe, verse 18, that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son, they asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that now he can see? Well, we know he is our son, the parents answered. But we know he was born blind, but now he can see now. Or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age, he will speak for himself. We're almost in the realm of the ridiculous. In order to deal with this, they're basically saying, there's been a conjuring trick here. This man was never blind in the first place. There may have been a blind man, but you've replaced him. There's been a sort of body replacement. Maybe he's a twin, just looks like him. But he's not the real man. That's what they're now saying. It's just not happened. And we go through this tortuous thing about where this miracle has happened, how it could have happened, until we get to verse 34, where basically they lose their control. You were steeped in sin at birth, they say to the man. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. They may have started with a sense of division, but the end in anger at what has happened. John helpfully explains what was going on under the surface. It's important for us to know. What was driving these Pharisees not to just take this situation at face value, which is a remarkable event? Consider the fact that even in the Bible where we see God intervene in nature, there is no occasion that I can think of where a man who is born blind is healed. There's no occasion that I know. But instead of that, there is a hardness against Jesus. In fact, it's interesting how John comments on it so that we understand what's going on under the surface. Look at verse 22. His parents said this, that is, ask him, he's of age, he can speak for himself. They said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who already, get it? Who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, he is of age, ask him. Verse 24, a second time they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know that this man is a sinner. We've already decided that. Verse 27, I have told you already, you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? And they answered, they hurled insults at him and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. You were steeped in sin at birth. Dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. Do you see? Do you see what's going on under the surface? What's going on under the surface is the mind is already made up. There is no examination of the facts. There is no openness to the truth. There is no desire to step into the light, but rather to stay in the darkness. There is no wish to admit that what has happened has to be from God and has to come from this man, Jesus, who has already taken on the name of God only a few verses earlier. The Jewish mind, the Pharisees' mind, was closed like a steel trap against Jesus. We need to ask ourselves a serious question this morning. Just how prejudiced we are just how much are we prepared to give time to this Jesus? Or whether we've already made our mind up. We have no interest of ever having our mind changed. We have no interest in the truth. We have no interest of the light. We are quite happy where we are. I know someone, a colleague, who just said that to me one day. I've quoted him before. It's always stuck in my mind. I'm going back 40-odd years. 50 years. And he said, Peter, you could be telling me all the truth. This could be true. I'm quite prepared to believe it's true, but I don't care. I don't care. The mind is like a steel trap against Jesus. Could that be any of us this morning? But let's not stay in the darkness. Let's just briefly end in the light, because this is a great story. Do you know, when John writes this account that he was there and saw all this, and he writes it down in his gospel, I can almost see the relish on his face of writing this story. Why? Because as he writes it, it illustrates the purpose why he wrote the gospel at all. Because at the end of John's gospel, he tells us that I've written all of this so that you might believe that this Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you would have life. That is the purpose of John's gospel. If you don't know what it's about, just look at that verse. There it is. And so John is now writing this and saying, look, this happened to illustrate what faith is like. It's a journey for some of us. For some, it can be very seemingly a quick thing. One minute, we don't know Jesus. The next, we love him. I know that. That happened to me. But for many, it's not like that. And John reminds us it's not. Do you see the journey this man goes into? He talks about himself. And he says, how then were your eyes opened, they asked. He replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes, and he told me to go to Siloam and wash. He just knows him as his name. It is Jesus. Have you noticed something that we'll expand on next week, because we'll come back to the end of this passage, and that is that Jesus makes his way to the man, not the man to Jesus. Jesus takes the initiative in the whole of this story. It's very significant, and we will talk about it next week. But notice that having met with Jesus, he has to be obedient right from the beginning. Has to do something, doesn't he? What does he do? He goes to the pool of Siloam to wash. That was no easy matter. Because if Jesus met this man in the temple, which was in the northeast of Jerusalem, the pool of Siloam was in the southwest. So this blind man had to travel across Jerusalem to have his face washed in the pool of Siloam. He was obedient to Jesus. And this was an effort. This was a challenge to the man. Are you prepared to do this? Let me just say, for some of us, we wouldn't even cross the road to find out about Jesus. We would do nothing. We've got books that can tell us about Jesus. We're going to just talk to you about a book here in a minute that we could read and we could pass on. That is about Jesus. Some of us haven't even got the energy to do that. Some of us here have been doing Christianity Explored. That's 7 weeks of looking at Jesus. There is obedience. It is a desire to find out and to spend time to find out. But some of us, perhaps, won't do anything to find out the truth. This man does. And he knows that the man is Jesus. But then, if you look on, there's a development here. But others said, in verse 16, how can a sinner perform such signs? So they were divided. And then they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. The man replied, he is a prophet. Well, we've moved from just a name to the fact that this man is a godly man. He's a prophet. He must be. He can't just be an ordinary man. But then there's a huge boldness that takes over this man. I do admire him enormously. He is put under huge pressure. But he stands his ground. And it seems as he stands his ground, his understanding grows. And his faith in the man, Jesus, grows. Give glory to God by telling the truth, these Pharisees say. We know this man is a sinner. He replies, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. And even in the midst of insults, the man answers, now this is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from. Yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Do you see what's going on? The man has more common sense than these religious people. They're adding two and two and coming up with five. He is adding two and two and coming up with four. He knows now who this man is. He is a godly man. And I just want to just briefly mention the end, which we will come to next week again. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, you see, the initiative of Jesus again, in compassion and love, he comes to this man. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir? The man asked. Tell me, so that I may believe in him. And Jesus said, you have now seen him. Isn't that lovely? He'd met Jesus, but he'd never seen him until that day. Now he sees him. You have seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. Then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. The man sees Jesus in all his glory. He's moved from darkness physically to light. But spiritually, he is moved from darkness into light. Is that you and I? Do we know this Christ this morning? Do we know the life that he brings and the forgiveness and the knowledge of God and the future and hope and peace and love of God? Do we know this Christ? That is the question. Now, there is no doubt this man didn't know everything. He'd only just met Jesus. He didn't know all the intricacies and all the details, and neither do you and I. But we're not asked to. He knew enough. He knew enough to believe in him and to bow the knee to him and worship him as the Son of Man, as the Son of God, as Jesus Christ the Savior. He knew enough. And that is like us this morning. We may not know everything, but we know enough. That amazing statement of him. One thing I do know. I was blind, but now I see. Is that you and I? I was blind once, but I've met Christ in all his glory, and now I see. Is that you? Is that me? May it be so.